Chapter 24. Juan knew by how the diffused sunlight seeping around the drapes was the color of blood that he'd been asleep for only a couple of hours when the phone rang. He shimmied up against the headboard, feeling as if he'd just gone 15 rounds with a heavyweight champion of the world, and lost. "Hello," he said, working his tongue around his mouth to loosen the gummy saliva. "Sorry to disturb your beauty sleep." It was Max. If anything, he sounded as though he was enjoying waking the chairman. "We've got some major developments. I've called a meeting in the boardroom. 15 minutes." "Whet my appetite." Juan threw aside his sheets. The skin around his stump was red and swollen. One of Julia's orderlies was a professional masseuse, and he knew he'd need the leg tended to if he was going to function. "Daniel Singer plans to cause the biggest oil slick in history, and helping him is a mercenary army that we provided the weapons to." The news shocked any vestiges of sleep from Cabrillo's brain. He reached the boardroom in 14 minutes, his hair still wet from the shower. Maurice had coffee waiting for him and an omelet bursting with sausage and onions. His first thought was for Linda Ross. The diminutive intelligence officer was at her customary seat with a laptop opened in front of her. Her face had the pale, brittle look of a porcelain doll, and her normally bright eyes were as dull as old coins. Though only a few hours had passed since she began interrogating Susan Dunleavy, Linda seemed to have aged a decade. She tried to smile at Juan, but it died on her lips. He gave her a nod of understanding. Franklin Lincoln and Mike Trono were also present to make up for Eric Stone's and Mark Murphy's absence. Max was the last to arrive, and he was talking on a phone when he entered the room. "That's right. A coastal oil facility. I don't know exactly where, but your pilot must have some ideas." He paused a beat while he listened. "I know some of the radio tags must have failed by now. I also know that you overbuilt them enough so a coupler's still transmitting. You'll just have to get closer to find them." "Murph?" Juan asked after hastily swallowing a bite of his omelet. "I want him focusing on the coast. I did a little research and found there's a long string of offshore oil production platforms at the mouth of the Congo River that arc north to Angola's Cabinda province."
"Angola's to the south of the Congo," Eddie said.
"That's what I thought, too." Max eased himself into his chair. "But there is an enclave north of the river, and it's sitting on a couple billion barrels of oil. For what it's worth, I actually found out the U.S. gets more crude from Angola than it does from Kuwait, which pretty much negates the war for oil rant of a couple years ago."
Juan turned to Linda. "Want to fill us in?"
She straightened her shoulders. "As you all know, Daniel Singer forced Jeffrey Merrick to buy him out of the company. Since then, Singer's used his money to fund environmental groups, rainforest preservation in South America, anti-poaching efforts in Africa, and a lot of the best lobbyists money could buy in capitals all over the world. Then he began to realize that all the money he'd spent had done very little to change people's attitudes. Yes, he was saving a couple of animals and some tracts of land, but he hadn't made an impact on the fundamental problem. That problem being that while people say they care about the environment, when it comes down to dollars and cents, no one is willing to sacrifice their lifestyle in order to effect change."
"So Singer decided to get more radical?" Juan asked.
"Fanatical is more like it." Linda checked her computer for a second. "According to Susan, he became active with groups that burned down luxury homes under construction in Colorado, Utah, and Vermont, as well as destroying SUVs sitting on dealers' lots. She claims he used to put golf balls in the fuel tanks of logging trucks as well as sand in the oil filler tubes."
"Golf balls?" Link asked.
"Apparently the diesel will dissolve them, allowing the rubber strings inside to unravel. Does more damage than sugar or salt. Singer bragged that he'd caused at least $50 million worth of damage, but that still wasn't enough. He thought about sending bombs through the mail to top executives in the oil industry, but knew they would just end up killing some poor mailroom clerk. He also knew that it wouldn't change anyone's lives. That's when he heard how the hurricane seasons over the next couple of years are going to be particularly brutal. While it's part of a natural cycle, he figured the media would try to link it with global warming, and he wondered if he could make the storms even worse. So we were right about the undersea heaters installed off the coast of Namibia. It was more a question than a statement from Cabrillo. He cut off all ties with the environmental movement and set his plan in motion. He hired some top-flight climatologists and oceanographers to lay out the heater's size and location, though Susan says they were led to believe it was purely a research question and not something that would actually be built. They are designed to shift the Benguela current just enough so the temperature of the waters off West Africa rises a couple of degrees. And as we talked about before, more heat means more evaporation and a bigger and more powerful storm. It's impossible to change a hurricane once it's formed, Linda went on. Even a nuclear detonation wouldn't alter the eye structure, wind speed, or the storm's direction. However, by affecting what causes the storms in the first place, Singer believes he can create what he calls hypercanes, storms that register above Category 5 on the Saffir-Simpson scale.
What's this have to do with blowing up oil facilities? Eddie asked, helping himself to a cup of coffee from Juan's service. Here's where he's playing into media fears in a big way. The crude that's pumped from the waters near the Congo River has the highest percentage of benzene in the world. Alaska crude runs roughly one part per thousand. Oil from some of the newest fields off Angola and the Congo is 100 times that and higher. The crude is also contaminated with arsenic. This is removed at refineries, but when it comes out of the ground, it's a fairly caustic blend of oil and something called benzene arsenic acid, a known and tightly controlled carcinogen. He wants to sicken a bunch of West Africans? Link asked, disgusted by the idea.
Not exactly, although there will be some injuries here.
No, what he's after is to get the slick to disperse long enough so some of the oil evaporates. And once it becomes airborne, Juan concluded, the westerly winds will carry the toxic vapors across the ocean to the eastern seaboard.
The levels won't be high enough to sicken people in the United States, Linda said.
But Singer's banking on the panic caused by a toxic hurricane bearing down on the coast to get his point across.
Say he succeeds in dumping a lot of oil, Mike interjected. Can't it just get cleaned up before it becomes a hazard?
Two things would make that difficult, Juan said. Number one is that regulations concerning oil spills are pretty lax in this part of the world. They wouldn't have enough oil skimmer ships or containment boom. The second thing, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that Singer plans on causing enough damage to enough rigs that even with sufficient equipment, cleanup crews would simply be overwhelmed.
That's it in a nutshell, Linda agreed.
Local workers can contain an accidental spill from a tanker being improperly loaded, and maybe even if a ship was holed, but with Singer's army there preventing them from getting to work and oil continually flowing from damaged rigs and pipelines, there's nothing they could do.
How long after the oil is spilled would it take for the vapors to enter the atmosphere? Max asked.
Immediately, Linda said.
But it would be a week or so before it could potentially get carried across the Atlantic. It's Singer's mercenaries' job to hold those rigs for as long as they can. If they can hold out for a couple of days, we're talking a spill 100 times the size of the Exxon Valdez disaster.
Juan's eyes scanned the faces around him and said, So then it's going to be our job to prevent them from storming the rigs, and if we're too late, then we're going to take the damn things back again.
There might be a problem with that, Eddie said.
He folded his hands on the table. Linda, you told Max that Singer has hired Samuel Macumbo to storm the oil facilities?
Susan Dunleavy mentioned him by name, as well as his Congolese Army of Revolution. It's a straight pay-to-fight deal. Macumbo has no political stake in any of this. For a few million of Singer's dollars, Macumbo's willing to send in some cannon fodder.
Nice guy, Link said sarcastically. His men follow him because of their political beliefs, and he hires them out to die for someone else's.
I hate Africa.
I don't blame you, Eddie agreed. But can you see our problem? We supplied him with enough AK-47s, RPGs, and ammunition to outfit a couple hundred men.
Juan understood immediately.
The Oregon has the firepower to take on half the navies in the world, but it won't do us much good against individual terrorists aboard oil rigs who are using workers as shields.
Precisely. Eddie leaned forward. Retaking the production platforms is going to require individual combat. Everyone on this crew is a capable fighter, but if Macumbo takes over just 5 rigs and puts 100 men on each, we're not going to take them back without losing at least 2/3 to 3/4 of our own people. And don't think Angola's army or police force is going to be much help, he added. It'll take them a couple of days just to get organized. By that time, Singer will have turned the entire Congo Delta into a stinking oil slick and sabotaged the rig so the flow may never be shut off. If we can't prevent him from storming the platforms, then we have a day at most to take them back.
Eddie's sober assessment hung in the air because no one in the boardroom could refute it. There came a quiet knock on the open boardroom door. Juan turned and was delighted to see Sloane McIntyre standing at the entrance. She wore a pair of baggy shorts and a plain white t-shirt. Her arm was in a sling across her abdomen. Her coppery hair fell in waves past her shoulders. It was the first time he had seen her wearing makeup. The mascara and shadow brought out the depths of her gray eyes, and the artful strokes of blush hid the pallor of her still recovering body. Her lips were full and shining.
"Hope I'm not interrupting," she said with a smile that said she knew she was.
Juan got to his feet.
"No, not at all. How are you feeling?"
"Fine, thanks. Dr. Huxley says I'll be good as new in a couple of weeks if I stick to the physical therapy regimen she laid out. The whole crew's talking about the rescue you pulled off and how you not only saved your men and rescued Jeffrey Merrick, but also freed some leader from Zimbabwe.
Believe me, it was a team effort.
I just heard voices and wanted to say hello."
She gave Juan a look. "You still owe me an explanation about what it is you all do and where you got this incredible ship.
And I'll tell you everything. I promise."
"You'd better."
She glanced over at Linda.
"I'll see you back in your cabin. See you, Sloane."
"So what the hell are we going to do?" Max asked bluntly to get the conversation back on track.
"Obviously we can contact Langston," Linda said. "If he can't clear the way for a rapid reaction force to be sent here, at least he can warn the governments of Angola and the Congo about a credible terrorist threat."
"What are our relations like with those countries?" Link asked.
"No idea."
"What about getting in touch with some of our people who've left the corporation, like Dick Truitt, Carl Gannon, and Bob Meadows?" Mike suggested. "I know Tom Reyes runs a bodyguard service in California."
"Do the oil companies have their own security forces?" Max asked.
"I assume they do.
Juan?"
"Huh?
Are we boring you?"
"No."
Cabrillo got to his feet.
"I'll be right back."
He was out the door before anyone could ask him where he was going. He stalked down the hallway, his broad shoulders bowed and his head down.
Decisions had always come easy to him, and this one was no different, but he had to ask a question before he committed himself. He caught up to Sloane as she reached Linda Ross's cabin.
"Juan," she said, startled by his sudden appearance and his deadly serious look.
"How sure are you about the diamonds being aboard the Rove?" he asked brusquely. For what he intended, even the considerable financial resources of the corporation weren't enough, and he doubted he could get the CIA to fund his plan appropriately.
"I'm sorry?"
"The Rove. How sure are you that the diamonds are aboard her?"
"I'm not sure what you..."
"If you were placing a bet, what would be the odds?
100 to 1?
1,000 to 1?
What?"
She composed herself for a second. H.A. Ryder was the best guide in Africa at the time, and he knew the desert better than anyone. I know as sure as I'm standing here that he got those men across the Kalahari. They had the stones when they reached the coast.
So they are on the Rove, then?"
"Yes."
"You're sure?"
"Positive."
"Okay. Thanks."
He turned to go, but Sloane placed a hand on his arm to stop him.
"What's this all about?
Why are you asking about the diamonds?"
"Because I'm going to promise them to someone if he helps me out."
"You don't know where the Rove is.
It might take years to find her." Juan gave her a wolfish grin.
"I've got someone who owes me a favor who's going to find her for me."
"Who are you giving the diamonds to and why?"
Caught up by Juan's determination, Sloane had forgotten for a moment who she worked for and what had brought her to Namibia in the first place.
"Wait just a second. Those stones don't belong to you. They belong to my company."
"According to maritime law, they belong to whoever finds them. As for why I want them, come with me."
Juan stopped first at his cabin to get an item out of his safe. When they reached the guest suite, Juan knocked and entered. Moses Ndebele was sitting on the floor in the living room talking with four of his men. All of them were heavily bandaged. Canes and crutches littered the floor like a giant version of a children's game of pickup sticks. But none of it mattered. They were all smiling that their leader was back. Moses made to get to his feet, but Juan waved him down.
"Your Dr. Huxley tells me that there is no need for me to be shopping for a new leg," Ndebele said.
"I'm glad to hear it. I can function with one, but I sure as hell wish I still had them both," Juan said as they shook hands.
"May I speak to you in private?"
"Of course, Captain."
He said a few words to his followers, and they slowly got up from the floor and hobbled to the bedroom. Juan waited until the door was closed before speaking.
"What are the chances of you ever overthrowing your government and returning prosperity to Zimbabwe?"
"You are a man, so we will speak as men. I have eager fighters but few weapons. And if the people rise up to support a poorly armed revolt, they will be gunned down. My government is ruthless. Its leaders are willing to commit any atrocity to remain in power."
"What would it take to topple them?"
"It is the same for any problem. Money and time."
"I can't do anything about the time. But what if I could fund your movement?"
"Captain, I know you are a brave and honorable man, but you are talking about tens of millions of dollars."
"Mr. Ndebele, I'm talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, actually."
Juan paused a beat to let that sink in and then added,
"And it's yours, but I'm going to need something from you in return."
"For now, I will not ask about the money," Moses said. "Friends do not discuss such matters. What is the favor you seek?"
"I need 100 of your best fighters," Cabrillo told him. He then explained the situation.
Ndebele listened wordlessly, although Sloane gasped when he described a hurricane laden with poison bearing down on the United States, most likely gunning for her native Florida.
My people are willing to sacrifice themselves for their children and the future of our country, Ndebele said when Juan had finished. You are asking me to send them into a battle for which they reap nothing and risk all. For what you have done for me, I would fight by your side anywhere you asked. But I cannot ask my men to do this thing.
But they are fighting for their country, Juan countered. By doing this, you will secure the financial resources to oust your government and return Zimbabwe to the democracy you all fought for when you first gained independence. I'm not going to lie to you and say that all of them will be coming back, because they won't. But their sacrifice will be the rally cry for your followers. Explain to them what they will achieve, and they will do it for you, for your country, and most important, for themselves.
Ndebele said nothing for a few moments as he looked into Cabrillo's eyes. I will take this to an Indaba, a council of my men. He waved at the closed bedroom door. And I will let them decide.
I can ask for nothing more, Juan said and shook Ndebele's hand again. He withdrew a pouch from his pocket and turned Ndebele's hand flat. Onto his open palm he poured the rough diamonds they had received in exchange for the weapons.
Consider this a good faith gesture. They're yours, no matter the decision. There's an intercom on the desk. The communications officer who answers will be able to find me.
Out in the hall, Sloane grabbed Juan's hand.
Is that all true? And where did you get those diamonds?
Unfortunately, it is. Daniel Singer has had years to plan this, and we only have a couple of days to stop it. As to where those diamonds come from, it's a rather long story that brings this whole mess full circle.
I guess I'll have to wait to hear that one, too.
Sorry, yes. I have to get back to the meeting. There's a lot we have to go over.
Sloane released his hand. I want you to know that I'll help you in any way I can.
Good. Because once we find the Rove, you're going to help me blackmail your bosses into buying those diamonds.
That, she said with a grin, will be my pleasure.
Before returning to the boardroom, Cabrillo went back to his cabin to place a ship-to-shore call. It was early morning on the East Coast, but he suspected the man he wanted to reach would be in his office. Juan had the direct number, and when the phone was picked up, he said without preamble, "You owe me a leg, but I'll call as even if you lend me a hand."
"It's been a while, Chairman Cabrillo," Dirk Pitt replied from his office high atop the Numa building overlooking Washington, D.C.
"What can I do for you?"